Peter B. Collins News and Comment, Tuesday, May 13, 2014.
Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you.
I love you
because you.
Because you.
Really listen.
Oh, the NSA will have all ears listening for quite a while now, because Glenn Greenwald has resurfaced for a media blitz to promote his new book. And it's based, of course, on the revelations of Ed Snowden. And I actually saw the book in an independent bookstore in Sonoma on Sunday. Today is the official release day. And the publisher hasn't sent me a copy yet, but I'll work on that and see if I can secure an interview with Glenn Greenwald. I also have a request. I don't know if it will be honored, but a request to interview Ed Snowden himself that I've put to some of the intermediaries who are in contact with him. Tonight, there'll be the first episode of a two-part special on the PBS Frontline investigative series that is based on the new Greenwald book called No Place to Hide. And this does explain a little bit about the recent very quiet, limited activity at Glenn Greenwald's journalism website, the e-zine called The Intercept. He hasn't posted anything based on Snowden documents in over a month, and it's caused some speculation. There is a new editor at First Look who apparently is in charge of The Intercept, and he put up a post saying not to fear, that they are, working on developing systems and infrastructure. And, of course, they did rush the whole operation into action earlier this year. So some of these things are understandable. At the same time, Glenn Greenwald can be a very prickly fellow. And some of that prickliness has shown up in his response to criticism that's come from some quarters, including my friend Sibel Edmonds and many others who have raised legitimate questions about the whole range of activities and whether Greenwald and the other journalists have truly honored the intentions of Ed Snowden, etc. So one of the tidbits that I saw posted on Facebook, and I don't have direct access to this information yet, but it cited Stephen Colbert in an interview with Greenwald, which may have been broadcast last night. I've been pretty busy, had some relatives visiting, and I didn't get to do much of my regular television viewing over the last few nights. So I'm not sure if the Colbert interview has already aired or if this is a leak from an interview that may be scheduled to be broadcast tonight. In any event, a longtime listener and a longtime subscriber here, Joe Clarici, put a post up on my timeline at Facebook with the Colbert-Greenwald exchange. And from it, we get the word that Greenwald says that the really big, big, big story based on Greenwald's, Snowden's documents has not yet been published. And Clarici, just speculating, but it fits my bias, wondering if the revelations that Russell Tice made to me and Sibel Edmonds last year, that our top elected officials have been routinely surveilled, wiretapped, and otherwise monitored by the NSA, if that is the blockbuster that Glenn Greenwald is teasing. Well, only time will tell, and we've got time. So we'll tell when the time is right. Meanwhile, I want to commend Zoe Lofgren. She is a 10- or 12-term member of the House of Representatives, and she serves a district near San Jose in Silicon Valley. She is trained as an attorney. In fact, I have a friend who was dating her in law school at the University of Santa Clara. That goes back a few decades. Anyway, Zoe is a constitutionalist, and she also is a realist. And so what I'm about to tell you has both good news and bad news. The good news is that Zoe Lofgren understands what true NSA reform would look like, and that the bill that is most likely to pass the House of Representatives, called the USA Freedom Act, and I choke on these bill titles, it reminds me of the Patriot Act and these other things that have these names that belie the pernicious elements of the law that it is the name for. So Lofgren has been trying diligently to amend the USA Freedom Act with what I see as two primary objectives. One is to restore the civil libertarian elements of it that have been softened or deleted in recent weeks. And number two, she is trying to rein in the NSA on what was recently exposed related to the Heartbleed bug and other information that surfaced from it. And people may recognize that in the last few days there have been stories circulating that the NSA has been able to find defects in routers, in switchers, in hardware and software, and they identify these glitches, and then they exploit them, either by using them as a backdoor or by using them for control systems that you and I might not fully understand. And so Lofgren is trying to prevent the NSA from, quote, utilizing discovered zero-day flaws. Zero-day is the release day of a particular piece of hardware or software, and entrench that the duty of the NSA and the government is not to create these flaws, not to prolong the threat to the Internet by failing to warn about those vulnerabilities. And some of the NSA whistleblowers, like Bill Binney, have told us that they believe that, for example, the vulnerability that Target experienced, where, you know, millions of credit card records were hacked or copied, that these levels of limited security have been insisted on by the NSA so that they can hack in at will. So, that's the good news of what Lofgren is attempting to do. But it's a very dicey situation, and all these roads lead to Dianne Feinstein on the Senate side, because the House is trying to pass a bill that the Senate will also embrace. And that's one of the complications that Lofgren is facing. Also, there are, of course, Republicans in the House who are not in favor of the constitutional fixes that she is proposing. So what we are learning from this is that there will be limited amendments, if any, to this USA Freedom Bill. And just last week, Lofgren fought and lost in the Judiciary Committee trying to strengthen the safeguards relating to phone record metadata collection. And as it stands now, the watered-down version of this bill allows massive metadata collection to continue with single court orders that affect millions of people who have not been seen as suspects or there's no probable cause to surveil them. And so this is what's really going on. And Lofgren, as I mentioned, is a realist who's been in the House for many years, and she's trying very hard to at least illustrate for us what the shortcomings are of what will probably be the best prospect of limited NSA reform coming out of the Congress this year. And so it boils down to what I have been unfortunately saying for a long time, and that is that they don't have any real intention of restoring our constitutional rights and limiting the role of the NSA to its original mission, which is to do spying outside the country. And so a lot of this is just window dressing, some of it aimed at political constituencies that they hope will support certain elected officials, Republican or Democrat, in the midterm elections this fall. So I can't hold out much hope of meaningful reform. But I do express my gratitude to Zoe Lofgren and a few others, like Adam Schiff from Southern California, who have tried to move the House of Representatives in the right direction. Interesting reaction to a story that we reported on here last week from our colleague and longtime friend Jason Leopold. He published a story at Al Jazeera America based on Freedom of Information Act disclosures of email exchanges between the NSA's former boss, Keith Alexander, and top executives at Google, including Eric Schmidt and Sergey Brin. And what is interesting in Yasha Levine's take on this, Yasha is a great reporter at Pando.com, and I've interviewed him several times for my Processing Distortion series over at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And Levine, without actually quoting the response of a blog post at the New York Times, which poo-pooed Jason Leopold's disclosure, saying, ho-hum, who cares if Keith Alexander sends emails to Sergey Brin and to Eric Schmidt, inviting them to classified briefings and thanking them for their prior help? Well, that New York Times blog was basically asking, what's the big deal? And so Yasha Levine answers that. He says, well, it is a big deal. And then he traces, and I'm going to link to his lengthy article so you can read it for yourself, but he traces the history of interaction, collaboration, shall we say collusion, between Google and NSA going back to 2003, when Google got the contract to help develop Google Earth in cooperation or under the direction of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the NGA. And he goes through other episodes that I have talked about in the past and concludes that this cozy relationship between Google execs and the NSA is a big deal and is very troubling. Today, we released to our subscribers an in-depth interview about something not related to our government or to spies. It's about Lyme disease and related chronic illnesses. And this entire program was prompted by a longtime listener and a subscriber to this podcast, Natalie Reel, who lives in the wilds of Montana. And she's been a listener since we started podcasting 5 years ago in June. And she, in a series of emails, first responded to an interview I did about 2 years ago with filmmaker Andy Abrahams Wilson about his documentary about Lyme disease and about the battle of the medical establishment against doctors who treat patients with chronic Lyme and other disease conditions. So we put this show together with Natalie Reel. She calls in toward the end of the show and talks about how just a year ago she found out that she got a firm diagnosis that she has Lyme and other interrelated conditions. And we also interviewed Dr. Richard I. Horowitz, who appeared in Andy Abrahams Wilson's film called Under Our Skin, and has since published a book called Why Can't I Get Better? And Horowitz does a great job of describing the entire spectrum of illnesses that are related to Lyme disease. Here's an excerpt from that conversation with Horowitz, Wilson, and Natalie Reel.
Sure. I mean, well, the problem is right now is that people have assumed with Lyme disease that it's due to one cause, which is a bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi that causes Lyme disease. The problem that I found is that the people who have chronic symptoms after classical treatment for Lyme, when they take 30 days of an antibiotic, they usually have multifactorial causes for their illness. And I call the syndrome Lyme MSIDS. And MSID stands for Multiple Systemic Infectious Disease Syndrome, and it's representing up to 16 different medical problems that contribute to persistent symptoms. So, for example, many of my patients have co-infections. In fact, I would say over 50% of the reason they don't get better is they've got infections like parasites like Babesia, which will cause you to have day sweats, night sweats, chills, air hunger, a cough that you can't explain. If you don't get rid of this parasite and you just treat for Lyme, you're not going to get better. And then similarly, people have environmental toxins and heavy metals. They don't detoxify these chemicals well. They don't get to sleep. They might have food allergies and sensitivities, imbalances in a part of their nervous system called the autonomic nervous system that deals with the heart rate, the blood pressure, the digestive system. It's, I mean, I use this analogy. It's like going into a doctor with 16 nails in your foot, telling him you have foot pain. The doctor finds one or two nails, pulls them out. You go back and say, I still have pain. And they said, well, I did everything I can. And they're not realizing that the Lyme is affecting the body. It's affecting the hormones of the body. There are other viruses and things that have got into your body, and it's not just about Lyme. And this kind of resolves, in a sense, the big political problem that's going on of, you know, 30 days antibiotics doesn't work, so therefore it's useless. Well, no, it's not useless. These are chronic persistent infections, including some of the co-infections. But the reason those double-blind studies didn't work, they weren't looking at all of the things that I found are wrong in my patients.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Dr. Horowitz, filmmaker Wilson, and our listener Natalie Reel. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. We explore the issues of how the medical boards in certain states have punished doctors who pursue treatment for patients with long-term chronic illnesses related to Lyme disease. And there's been what have been called the Lyme Wars, as insurance companies, HMOs, and others try to limit the coverage for individuals who have Lyme and its related illnesses on a chronic basis. So it to me, is very important, particularly for people who have been touched by this group of conditions. And I hope you will check it out at peterbcollins.com. I also like to thank the people who subscribe and support my work here at the podcast. And today we give a shout out to Alan Van Tress, Dan Channon, Mark Giorgini, and Trevin Pinto. They've all put cash into the Peter B. Collins podcast recently, and I'd like you to join them. I need your support here. This is the free podcast that goes out. We don't check your financial ability. But if you've got some bucks in the bank and you're working, may I ask you to support this? $5 a month, $10, $20, whatever fits your budget. Just go to peterbcollins.com, follow the link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage, and you'll get those options. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And for new annual subscribers in the U.S., we've got bonus gifts, including John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. The Do-Nothing Congress continues to do what it does best. Absolutely nothing. Today, the United States Senate defeated a bill that in part had some good components. It was attempting to address energy efficiency and kind of the edges of the climate change debate. But because Republicans insisted on trying to insert the Keystone XL pipeline and override the president's prerogatives on that issue, the bill did not pass, and it is dead after a 55-36 vote. And what this shows is that the, and we've got Rob Portman here, Republican from Ohio, who, you know, has some crocodile tears. Today's failure to move forward on a bipartisan energy efficiency bill is yet another disappointing example of Washington's dysfunction. But the Republicans didn't want this bill to go forward, and that's why they put the poison pill of the Keystone XL pipeline into it. And, of course, they're getting ready to fight the president, who they claim is waging a war on coal because he's trying to reduce carbon emissions, and coal-fired power plants are a major source of that. So this really comes down to a kind of Keystone Cops situation. And for some of our younger listeners, that may be a reference that doesn't compute for you. Back in the talkies, before we had movies where you could actually hear the voices of people, the silent films, there were some very funny comedy pictures. They were usually short features called the Keystone Cops. And it was all sight gags, kind of like the Three Stooges. And so Keystone Cops is a dated reference to foolhardy law enforcement officials. And to me, what Congress is doing is on the level of Keystone Cops as they wrangle over the Keystone XL pipeline. And while they're fiddling, Rome is not burning, but the glacier ice masses are melting much faster than even the climate change scientists had predicted. And it's really stunning if you've seen some of the photographs. Dar Jamail, a longtime friend of ours who has just returned to the United States after working for Al Jazeera in Qatar for a few years, is working for truthout.org. And note to self, I've got to catch up with Dar and get him to reappear on our program. I'll link to his latest report at Truthout, which recaps some of the recent alarming developments related to the human influences on the change of the climate. And he ticks off a few different items here. Let's see. One of the threats is an assessment by the world's leading scientific body that the rise of 4 to 5 degrees centigrade before the end of this century is quite likely. and that if we have a 4-degree centigrade warming, it would mean a devastating impact on agricultural and human civilization. A report in April showed that the CO2 emissions have now exceeded 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, and they threaten the entire marine food chain, given that 90% of the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is absorbed by the oceans. And there are many other aspects here, too many to mention, but I encourage you to read Dar's article and get a sense of just how bad things are and how how oblivious our elected leaders are. And I include Obama. He's paid lip service to these issues, but he's not really putting anything serious on the line to try to change the dynamic here. Just a lot of nibbling around the edges. You may have heard that last week, Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky who wants to be president, who does occasionally take positions that I agree with, told a New York Times reporter regarding the Republican binge on state-level voter ID requirements, where you have to have a picture ID to vote. Rand Paul told reporter Jeremy Peters, "Everybody's gone completely crazy on this voter ID thing. I think it's wrong for Republicans to go too crazy on this issue because it's offending people." Well, to my liberal ears, that sounded like, wow, Rand Paul understands that there is no real voter fraud in this country and that this is a voter suppression tactic used by Republicans with the thin veneer that it's to clean up a voting process that doesn't have that kind of corruption. Oh, the money is corrupting, but voters don't operate in a way that violates the law. And so now they're spinning this up because the right wing and the Republican establishment is saying, hey, Rand, if you want to be president, we need to suppress a lot of liberal and Democratic votes. So this is in your best interest. So they trot out an advisor to Rand Paul who says, "Senator Paul was having a larger discussion about criminal justice reform and restoration of voting rights. In the course of that discussion, he reiterated a point he has made before, that while there may be some instances of voter fraud, it should not be a defining issue of the Republican Party, as it is an issue that is perhaps perceived in a way it is not intended." Oh, politics, isn't it beautiful? You may recall, after the Boston Marathon bombing and after the FBI had the shootout that killed Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and then they captured his younger brother, Dzhokhar, in a boat on a trailer in a suburb of Boston. And in the days after the Tsarnaev brothers were identified, it is alleged that friends of the younger Dzhokhar destroyed evidence and lied to investigators. Now they are on trial. Two of them are nationals of Kazakhstan. And they are the ones who are accused of tampering with evidence by removing Tsarnaev's laptop and a backpack containing fireworks from his college dorm room shortly after the fatal bombing last year. And the other guy is accused of lying to investigators. Now, all of them want to have a change of venue. They want to have the trial moved out of Boston because they don't feel they can get a fair trial. I think they have a pretty strong argument there, but prosecutors are opposed to any change, and we'll see if the trial went forward today, but that's what was expected to happen. A few international updates for you. The United Nations mediator, who was trying to broker talks to end the civil war in Syria, has resigned his post. 80-year-old Lakhdar Brahimi has said that it was going nowhere. Those are my words, not his. And so it's very clear that with the Assad government running for re-election, with the array of internationally funded rebel groups failing to topple the Assad government, that this quagmire is going to continue for a long time. And many more people will die. The nation of Syria, at least in many pockets, is just shelled and shell-shocked. Now we have an allegation from Human Rights Watch that Syria's army has recently used chemical weapons in a very crude manner. And before I go into any further detail about this, I have to tell you that I'm very wary of Human Rights Watch. I don't consider it to be an independent, credible organization anymore. Tom Malinowski, who's one of the leaders of Human Rights Watch in the U.S., I've interviewed a couple of times, have not been impressed with his level of persistence and determination. And back in the Bush years, when I talked to Malinowski, I thought he was pretty soft on the clear human rights abuses at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, often, you know, minimizing, rationalizing things that were deeply troubling and offensive to me. So with that said, Human Rights Watch is reporting that forces loyal to President Assad in Syria likely used chlorine gas on three towns in northern Syria in mid-April. Quote, evidence strongly suggests that Syrian government helicopters dropped barrel bombs. Now, these are really crude. They just put explosives into like a 50-gallon drum. They put shrapnel in there, kind of everything, including kitchen sinks. And apparently, some of these barrel bombs included tanks of chlorine gas. Now, that's a very crude weapon. And it's a very ineffective way to deliver a chemical agent. And it speaks to desperation as much as violation of international treaties. And one thing that is clear is that the opposition, even the, you know, worst of the mercenaries who are there for all the wrong reasons, they don't have any aircraft. They don't have a helicopter to drop a bucket bomb from. And it's pretty far-fetched to imagine that they could secretly drop a canister of chlorine gas into one of these crude bucket bombs before the Syrian folks lifted it into the air and then dropped it on what they consider to be terrorist positions. So I report this to you because I've heard about it, and I think it deserves further study. I still am wary of Human Rights Watch as a credible source on this issue, and the whole chemical weapons matter has been so highly politicized related to Syria that it's hard to know who's actually telling the truth. This came as a surprise to me. The former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, has been sentenced to 6 years in prison for bribery. When he was mayor of Jerusalem, he apparently took bribes in connection with the construction of a luxury housing development. Now, he's been fighting these charges for a long time. And honestly, I thought he would walk. And when I look at this, I say, wow, couldn't we use a little justice like that in this country? Or are all of our former elected officials immune from prosecution for clear crimes, much more important than bribery from a luxury housing development? And my final story today is about the squirt gun war between China and Vietnam. Only these squirt guns are not the kind that you and I can get a hold of. Naval ships have been trading fire using water cannons in a disputed area that Vietnam claims as part of its territorial waters, and China has brought in a deep-sea oil drilling rig to this area in the South China Sea that is claimed by both Beijing and Hanoi. Both sides have accused the other of ramming ships. Vietnam has delivered videos showing Chinese ships hitting its vessels. And now they are trading this water cannon fire. I hope it doesn't escalate any further, because I don't mind if they get wet. We just don't need another military conflict in our world at this time. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This is the podcast that you are authorized to share with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.